Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Hi, this is Dick Staub, and I want to thank you for joining me for this special edition of the Kindling's Muse. Join me as we listen to the speakers and guests at the Windrider Forum live at Sundance Film Festival 2012.
Welcome to Windrider 2012. I'm Camille Tucker. I'm one of the co-directors of Real Spirituality. And to my left, I'd like to introduce Ava DuVernay. She's the writer, director, and producer of Middle of Nowhere. And woo! Give it up. So a little bit about Ava. She's founder of the DuVernay Agency public relations firm, which when I first met her, as a publicist. The firm now is known as DVA Media and Marketing. And she has done publicity work. She started as a publicist in the entertainment industry, worked on over 99 films, and then has made her transition into a filmmaker, directing the female MC documentary about female MCs, which we rarely get to see, called My Mic Sounds Nice. And last year, she wrote and directed I Will Follow, and then this year, obviously, Middle of Nowhere. But she is also founder of a firm, let me get this right, the African American Film Festival Releasing Movement. So she is, so you are the founder and CEO of, it's a distribution company. A distribution company, which we know in entertainment industry, distribution is the key. So with all that said, I'd like to start with my first question. And I want to talk to you, when we were at the Q&A after the film, someone asked you about how you came upon this story, and I want to talk a little bit more about that. The character, Ruby, and when you create a story, do you start with a character? Do you start with the story? I want to talk a little bit more about your creative process with that, and then also if you did any research and what kind of research you did.
Sure. Well, first, just thank you for having me, Camille. I appreciate you
thank
inviting
you so
me
much
and
for
everyone
being here.
Involved. Will and Mr. I was just introduced to him. He was such a kind man. He had on a fantastic scarf. Was the last name Pretty?
Yeah, John Pretty.
That's fantastic. What a great way to go through life when your last name's Pretty. I hope all our lives are pretty. But I started with the world, not the character first. The world that I wanted to create, the world that I wanted to, not create, but actually portray, which was a world that I knew something about, growing up in Compton and really kind of just understanding that there were a lot of people around me who were the loved ones of the incarcerated. And because that's just a very tangible thing and something that's very openly discussed where I come from. My man's locked up. Yeah, my son's in jail. Yeah, where are you going this afternoon? Oh, I'm taking the bus up, you know, to go for a visit. Like, that's just standard conversation. Whereas when I went to UCLA and kind of moved into other communities and other areas of society, it became like a much more unspoken thing, even though it still existed. And so, I just went to kind of create that world, and from that, the characters emerged. And yes, I did do research. A lot of it was experiential, just having grown up in that environment and knowing what that was like. But also, as I started to actually create the character of Ruby, definitely meeting with, sitting down with, sharing the script with probably about 36 wives of the incarcerated, and just trying to make sure that there was some authenticity in her voice.
Anything striking that came out in your interviews with these wives? Like, was there anything that really struck you?
The loyalty and patience of which. Both of which, I mean, I think I'm a loyal person, but I don't know how patient I am.
Right.
So it's a momentous thing that they do. And I think it's sometimes taken for granted by the person that they're supporting inside. Mm-hmm. It's a weight, you know, and just their posture as they kind of go through life with this other big thing over here that most people don't know about or is not really, you know, accepted as being at the forefront of their life or their conversation. I mean, most women are kind of hiding it at work, You know what I mean? Their families know, but it's not something that family, you know, is really trying to tolerate and support. Mm-hmm. So it's talked about, but in terms of how much does the family support and for how long, those are some of the issues that came up. So that's why I tried to portray in our film, it's 4 years later. So you can imagine that our family was perhaps supportive at the beginning, but you have some comments where the sister's like, do you have to go every weekend? Mm-hmm. And the mother, you know, just kind of like that, where it becomes a drag to everyone around her and her. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, those were some of the things that came up.
Mm-hmm. What I wanted to know is, what is your process in the writing in terms of structure? Do you have any particular method, or how do you let your story develop, like, structurally wise? Like, right. What do you adhere to?
Right, that's a great question. Structure is super, super important. I mean, you gotta have it. You know, it's a skeleton, and you can have whatever kind of body. I mean, we all have the same skeleton. I have a few more rolls and curves than that guy, but it's the same bones, you know? And so I really believe that you have to have those bones. There's some experimental films, if you're doing different things, that's great. And I think, and I love a lot of those films, but ultimately, even a slight film, even a film that just has a small turn, and it's good, it's following the same beats when you break it down. So I've studied I've studied screenwriting in so many different ways. It took me a long time to find a process that worked for me. And really, it was, and I was always struggled with it. I mean, I sat in the McGee workshops.
Me too.
I read them all. The Joseph Campbell, I did it all, and I just couldn't grasp it in a way that it all fit for me until I read that Save the Cat, Save the Dog book.
Oh, Save the Cat.
And I was just like, oh, I get it. And so you just have to find a process that's right for you. What is it, Save the Dog or Save the Cat? The Cat?
Save the Cat.
That thing just really crystallized it for me in breaking down other screenplays so that I could really realize what the beats were I don't know, but it became very crystal clear for me, and you just have to find a process that's right for you. But yeah, I mean, hang on to structure, because I've sat through a couple films here at the festival and elsewhere that, you know, they lose me just because I don't have plot points to hang on to. And, you know, the big act two turning point doesn't have to be a car crash. It could be, you know, it could be a good cry. It could be she walks out the door. It doesn't have to be huge. There has to be those emotional turns just to keep people going. So it's about translating those big points into your own story. Mm-hmm. I don't know, did that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that was something that really resonated for me, because when I came out of the film, I said, for me, this film is a film about small turns that become big and profound moments. And earlier in the film, she tells Derek, Ruby tells Derek, she says, you are me. And at that point, they're one. And he was even talking about her being a martyr, what have you. And then there's the through line of her riding on the bus with the woman, and the woman tells her that she got suspended for kissing. And then there's the later several...
People see it?
Yeah.
How many people see it? Because she's about to give away the end.
I'm not giving any spoilers.
Who did not see it? Sorry, she's about to go in there.
I'm going in there.
Okay.
But this profound moment, which you shot very intimately, of her when she goes back into the prison, she's got this dress on. Yes. And now I understand the poster, because the poster is of her with the dress, and she's holding onto him. And she kisses him. And the kiss is the powerful, powerful moment. Which makes the turn. And I thought that was the moment of her, that she was emancipating herself. And so can you talk a little bit more about that moment? Just the kiss and what it meant for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a goodbye kiss. And and those are, I think, even more powerful than first kisses. And mm-hmm. we don't see them often enough. I think they have a lot of drama, a lot of poignancy to them. And certainly the whole film builds up to that point. But really, it's just the point when she kind of claims her freedom, her emancipation proclamation mm-hmm. in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, you know, at the end, you're not clear what she's going to do. And a lot of people want me to answer that question for them. You know, she doesn't know the answer. And she's really clear in that in her letter to him at the end. But I think, you know, a concrete knowing is so rare for any of us. You know, our knowledge is always evolving. What we know today and what we feel very certain about, you know, may change, even as faith evolves, even as how we feel about family, loyalties evolve, they change. And so I didn't want to just kind of put a period on the way that she feels about the situation, because that's just not true.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was purposeful. And yes, that kiss was, you know, definitely, her kind of taking control of her life at that point.
Right. And I love what you were saying about she doesn't really know what she wanted to do, because now I just want to talk a little bit about the themes I think it's in the tagline, it says it's a film about love as a choice. And it made me think about unconditional love, and I know as Christians in the Christian faith, that's like the cornerstone of our faith, like the whole idea of grace and love, and that the love of God is unconditional through Christ. But I was starting to ask myself, you know, well, with the humans, is it humanly possible to have that kind of unconditional love? And there's two sort of love as a choice relationships, I believe, one with her mother and then one with her husband, Derek, and they're different. So I wanted to just talk about the whole idea of like unconditional love versus like at some point, you know, having to put boundaries about love, put boundaries with our love. Like she seems almost codependent somehow in the beginning, or that she's willing to go wherever she has to go. She's making all of these sacrifices, but then at the end, that love sort of changes. And so I just wanted to talk about her love. Is it possible, the unconditional love, in terms of what you found with developing this character and the people that you interviewed? What are your thoughts about that unconditional love versus conditional love?
I mean, I believe that only God is capable of unconditional love. I mean, I just, even my mom, who loves me more than anybody in the whole world, you know, I can imagine there are things that I could do that would, you know, make it waver, and not be any less, not make it any less true, but maybe make it less strong. You know what I mean? She would always love me, but you know, certainly, I mean, if I murdered someone, or who knows what I could do. It would make it waver a little bit. And that's the person who I've never felt anything more than full strength, full power love from. And I just think there's really no one, you know, who can say that, that there's nothing you can do, nothing that can happen that can change the strength of my love for you except God for me. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, why God is God. And And then everything else is pretty much a choice in my mind. And it's our choice to either stay strong, stay fervent, stay focused, stay loyal, stay in the realm of a patient love, a pure love, to cultivate our love for one another, or not. You know, everything we're doing is a choice. Mm-hmm. And some people exercise that, more purely than others. And so this whole film was an exercise in the evolution of this woman's love. At the beginning, she's not codependent for me. She's, you know, a wife who took vows and is, you know, following through for her vows when it's worse and not better. Mm-hmm. Somewhere along the way, though, you know, she stops taking care of herself. And, you know, she starts to be in jeopardy herself emotionally. And so she has to, you know, love herself just as much as she's loving him. Mm-hmm. And then that love for herself changes how she's going to be able to respond to him. At the end, she doesn't leave him.
Right.
Lumber people came up to me after, like, are there divorce papers in that envelope? And is she going to leave him? And I don't think they're divorced. I mean, if you think they're divorce papers, that's great. I don't think there's divorce papers. She says clearly in the next scene, I sent you all your paperwork for your case to do what you need to do when you're ready. You know what I mean? It's you know, she's wavered in her vows. She's been strong with her vows. She's a little all over the place in this discovery of herself. But ultimately, at the end, you know, it's about her and not anyone else. Mm-hmm. But in terms of her marriage, you know, I don't see her leaving the marriage. I see her saying, you need to get yourself together. And if, you know, I'm going to be doing this while you're doing that, I can't do this time with you anymore in the way that I did it. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what your question was.
It was about unconditional love. But I also want to ask you, and that's what they say. Someone mentioned emotional incarceration or prison widows.
Right.
But I also want to talk to you about the family relationship and the love with her mother, or just the relationship dynamic with her mother, because I think that's another universal thing. We can all relate to parents and how much they care for their children, but also it's a different depiction of an African American family. But I see in her mother the desire to break a negative cycle, but maybe not completely understanding her daughter and her love and the love she has for her husband. So I want to talk a little bit about what were you hoping to portray, or what were you exploring in the mother-daughter relationship?
Just dysfunction. Mm-hmm. You know, it really just comes from not communicating with each other. They don't have any kind of language, You know, they're just not connecting in the way that they say. You could see, I hope, that the mother is, you know, in love with her daughters and wants the best for them. And for whatever reason, when it comes out of her mouth, it's harsh. You know what I mean? And I have people like that in my life, and that's, and sometimes I'm like that, you know, where you just, it obviously I'm not saying what I feel in the way that's, I feel like I'm turning from you guys, I'm sorry, these people over here. Obviously I'm not communicating it in a way that it feels inside me. And so that's one of the things that I want to explore. They can't communicate for whatever reason. All families just, you know, aren't like that, where you say what you feel and you, oh, I get it. You think this. It's like, I just don't come from a family like that. So I wanted to explore that without it being like a big deal. It's just part of the fabric of their relationships. Like, they just don't get along. And the core of it is they just can't speak to each other heart to heart for whatever reason. I mean, even the mother in that last scene in the dinner, she's trying to create an environment where they talk. And, you know, it's just, they say, this is painful. We just can't do this. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, there, I don't think I was just trying to make a comment. I was really just trying to present another view of a family unit from my experience. And maybe you recognize something in it from your experience. And you say, wow, are we that bad? Like, when you look through the window, does it look like three strangers sitting there? Mm-hmm. And if so, maybe, you know, it would prompt you to reevaluate some of your own relationships.
Mm-hmm. And, well, that's one thing I love about the film, too, is that it doesn't appear that you're trying to push any agenda or make us arrive at any thought. You're sort of giving us a view into this experience. And, I was looking at some statistics, and I know you didn't really deal with this in the film, but in 2005, and I think this is from the Federal Bureau of Prisons or what have you. It's 2005, they said, African Americans make up 12% of the U.S. population, but 40% of the prison population. Latinos make up 15.8% of the U.S. population, but 21% of the prison population. There's a disparity in the number of minorities or people of color who are incarcerated. And it was interesting because even on the bus ride and when she was visiting in prison, I noticed you had a different, it was multicultural. You didn't touch on anything like that or had like any political statements, but what are your thoughts about like these numbers and just that whole thing about systematic racism in terms of your dealing with the film? Did it have anything to do with your desire to do this kind of film and tell this kind of story?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, really, my desire to tell the story was to get to show what the life of the loved ones of the incarcerated were. Within that, I welcome the fact that it allows me to talk a little bit more about the prison system. And I mean, it's a complex, the prison industrial complex, as I call it.
Right. Yeah. Which is
a
big thing.
You know, the rates of people in prison are disproportionate to the crimes that are committed. You know, there are other people committing crimes than black and brown people, I'll just say that. They're not going to jail for as long and as harshly as people of color are, and that's just period. If you look at those numbers and you think that black and brown people are the only ones committing crimes, then I would invite you to study more. And it's challenging, it's heartbreaking because it's deteriorating and has been, you know, the fabric of our communities when all of our men are gone. You know, a lot of it's a lot. And those numbers that you quoted are 2005. You know, they're new numbers that are even more stark and more startling. So, you know, I'm a little more radical. I subscribe to the views of the people that feel that there should be no prisons. So abolition of prisons totally, and to look at other ways to, you know, punish crime, punish criminals. The prison system isn't working. It's not working. People aren't being rehabilitated. Crime is not going down. We've been doing this for decades and decades. It's not working. It's time for us as a society to try to figure out new ways to look to countries and communities that are doing things differently. But that's not going to happen because prisons make a lot of money for people, for a lot of money. And so anyway, I'm not going to get all Angela Davis on you right now.
But, did you say Angela Davis?
I did.
Oh, okay.
And I've had the chance. She's a big prison abolitionist, and I've had the chance to sit down with her and talk about this. And you know, there are other ways to do things. But, you know, we'll see. In the meantime, we have to try to keep our inmates healthy and rehabilitated and keep the families that they're leaving behind healthy and just try to rebuild these communities somehow.
Mm-hmm. And that I think it's a pressing issue, you know, in the Christian community as well, because the whole idea is that, you know, whether people, they argue and debate whether this was a Christian nation or founded as a Christian nation, but either way, the whole thing of redemption and grace and restoration, I think most people would agree that in the prison system, that's not really what we're seeing, the rehabilitation, the restoration. And I know for my brother in particular, he served 2 years and it was in a you know, white collar, and he came out and he did just fine. But for the people, I actually ended up going into prison ministry during the time because I was just so compelled. And seeing all of these, I was like, is this where my date from Friday night went? Like, all the beautiful, intelligent black men are in here, you know? I was like, they're all here. But it was heartbreaking for me. And during the times when I was go in there and even just have conversations and be doing ministry in groups, there was in group settings, and going, you know, these guys were professionals. They were, you know, these were white collar. And that there's definitely something that needs to be done differently. And that sometimes the prisoners, and just what he did, and I've seen this story so many times, they sabotage themselves before they're about to get out because they don't really know how they're going to reintegrate into society. Yep. So that's something that we really have to look at. And I wanted to ask you also, and I'm going to open it up, but I wanted to ask you this one question before I open it up to the floor, which is, you, when I first met you and a lot of people in this industry and they've seen your journey, you started as a publicist. Some of the people in our audience, we have theologians, we have undergraduate students, we have some film students, some people want to go into film, some people don't, but they are interested in that conversation. And I want to talk about your transition from publicist to filmmaker and how you made that transition. And then also some people say, well, if you didn't go to film school, what right do you have to become a filmmaker?
Who says that? Are they in here?
But I want to talk about that. Like, so how did you make the transition and what are some of the specific things that you did to sort of break that mold of people seeing you as a publicist? And then to become a filmmaker?
No, that's an interesting question. I went into film publicity only because I love film and didn't think that I could be a filmmaker. It wasn't like, oh, I want to be a filmmaker, but I can't. It just didn't even enter my head. As a black woman from Compton, when I went to UCLA, I remember in that time when trying to figure out what I wanted to do, I loved film, but the idea of making them never entered my mind. And I don't know if that's because I did not know of any black women who did it. I wasn't really even consuming black film at that time. You know, my mom would take me to whatever was playing, and it usually wasn't black. Right. So as I went through UCLA and I graduated, I knew that I wanted to work in film because I loved it so much, and publicity was something that I fell into as a first job and really loved and was good at. And so when I was 27, I left the big agencies and the studio that I was working for and opened my own agency, and that company did really, really well. And my specialty was, I was a 27-year-old black woman who knew publicity really well and had worked for studios in the publicity area. And so when they had a film that had some black people in it, but they wanted it to be mainstream, or they, you know, they didn't quite know what it was going to be, like, I would come in as a specialist to cross it over, cross it back, get you black folk, make sure that you still were booked on Leno, you know, just like, make sure you were on BET and Leno. Like, that's kind of what I did. And so, we had a lot of success with that for a lot of years. Did Dreamgirls, did Invictus, did Collateral, did Shark Tale, did all types of TV and film. But as I was doing all that, I'd be on these sets. And I'd be watching these filmmakers and be like, that's really what I want to do. Like, why can't I do that? And started to learn and educate myself to the fact that there had been black women that had done this, you know, Julie Dash and Gina Prince Bythewood and Casey Lemons. And there were four, but they were doing it. And so, somewhere along the line, when my agency was full throttle, I decided to make a short, loved it. Made a couple docs, loved it, and then it just became a very gradual transition into the first feature, which I think helped me because people were hearing that I was making little things. I was hiding it for a long time because I didn't want my clients to know, you know. Everyone's got a script in L.A., so it's like I didn't want to be that person. it became, I think for me, the transition from publicity to filmmaker, it was gradual. Like, people in the industry knew little, like, I was, oh, she has a Doc at the festival, and oh yeah, she made this short that's on Showtime, and but was still doing publicity all the way up until last year. My last film, my film I Will Follow, came out in theaters in March. The last film that I worked on as a publicity strategist was The Help in August. Wow. So, I mean, this is like my first Sundance. I've been here, this is my ninth Sundance, my first as a filmmaker. Every other time I was here representing films as a publicist. And so, I've just kind of went full time in September.
Okay, wow.
And
I mean,
someone said,
it's great.
I'm free. No publicity.
Emmy's,
I mean, it's great publicity, but, you know,
and now
my
you
heart
get to
is
have
filming.
A publicist.
I do. I know. Poor guy. I was like, I need to see your schedule. Who'd you pitch? Who'd you talk to? What they say? Let me call myself. It was bad.
Emmy but. Said that you are a force of nature.
My publicist?
No, Emmy, the actress.
Emmy Hatsi.
She said you're a force of nature. But did you take a class? Did you take any film directing classes?
Yes. I studied... I did UCLA Extension at night.
Okay.
I did a private directing coach named Judith Wesson. She has a very famous book called Directing Actors, and so she has classes for directors in LA. So I studied with her for 3 years.
Wow.
I'd do my agency, I'd put a premiere together for a studio, and then I'd run over for my, you know, bi-weekly sessions with Judith. I did script breakdown with private coaches, just learning screenwriting. I did a lot of UCLA Extension, gave them a lot of money.
There you go, y'all.
Also UCLA studied at AFI. They did a series of private seminars for some industry people that were looking to make a transition. I had the real luxury to a lot of the directors that I've represented and worked with to actually sit down, break down my script with them, observe them on set, shadow them on set, big directors. And actually, I mean, I don't think there's any better way to learn than to actually talk to people who've done it. So, you know, everything from how to deal with an actor who doesn't want to come out of the trailer to, you know, what do you say when you don't know what to say on the set? And they're like, what's my motivation? And you're like, just do it. No. Do what I say. That's my motivation. No. You know, how do you communicate with the act? I'm kidding. I would never say that. But
I
how do
give,
you...
give some people a chance to talk, because they're going to be mad because I hogged you up. But
sure.
Questions. Oh, I think you were first over there.
Hello? Oh, there we go. I really enjoyed your film. Like, I resonated a lot in a weird way, because I'm not a woman. And... But she just, I liked your portrayal of free will and choice, because there is no easy answer to a lot of these situations. I did have questions about why you decided to make her very lonely. She didn't have a lot of input from friends, and her family was strained, and her husband obviously cut that tie kind of when he cheated on her. And I was wondering why you wanted her to be so lonely and have to fight for herself without... not even a God figure, but something else that you can cling to. So I was just wondering why you made that decision in the film, and why she ended that way too. Like, she had to be her own savior in a way, and I was just wondering why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that was just a choice really based on conversations with women. I mean, it becomes a very isolating process. You become isolated from a lot of friends don't want to hang out with you when you just want to talk about your husband in prison and go visit him. You know what I mean? It becomes a very singular focus in terms of the journey of the women of the incarcerated. And so, you know, whether it's a mother, a daughter, a sister, a wife, you know, they all one thing in common when I asked about their social life, there wasn't one really. It's about work and it's about maintaining that relationship. And so that's just the truth of what that's like for most. Even to the point when her sister says, let's go out, and she's like, I don't want to. She has to be dragged out in the early scenes and sorry? Somebody say something? Oh.
No.
So that's just the truth of those that type of lifestyle per my research.
Okay.
First, say thank you so much for this film. Thank you for using your gifts for good and not evil, and writing a beautiful story in a beautiful way, especially for an African American actress to have a role that just, yeah. Anyway, my question is, lately I seem to have had a lot of conversations with Black people, with other people about Black directors who are commercial, as opposed to Black directors who are more independent. And the images that some of the commercial films put out, and whether black directors in general have almost a responsibility. We've got to show everything, but we've got to show it in a certain way. And if you could just speak a little bit, I mean, how much do you carry the weight of your opening a window that people don't get to look into very often? Is that a great responsibility, or does it sometimes feel like a weight?
Yes, it's a responsibility, and it never feels like a weight. It feels like an honor that I'm allowed to make films and that I'm allowed to be a voice that shows that guy, you know, how a black woman puts on her scarf at night and how, you know, a woman who has to go and kind of deal with this prison thing, how she walks, how maybe to change his mind about what that woman is like. Just like a frozen river does that for me with a woman from Appalachia or wherever she was from, right? A place that I'll probably never go. And I may have preconceived notions of what that woman's life is like or how smart she is or how passionate she is or what her dreams are. And that film shows me, wow, she's like me. It's the same woman, really. She's just in different skin in a different place. And so I think it's an honor to be able to do that. And in terms of black filmmakers, I think, you know, I'm just a little bit radical in my view. When you make a film with a studio, it's not your film. That's just it. It's not. It's a film by committee. Some people do that better than others. Some people are able to keep an authentic voice through that process, and some aren't. I mean, you have input from everyone else. As an independent filmmaker, that's my film. That's my voice. That's my heart. That's everything that no one at any point said. They could have said it, but I would have been like, duly noted. And let's keep going. You know, so you know, you make a choice as to the way that you want to make films. If I want bigger budgets, I have to make a film by committee, and that's a choice. If I want to make the film that I want to make without interference, I make it with less money independently.
You know? And they're definitely going to be coming after you, Ava, so you'll have to be faced with that choice soon.
We have one right here.
Oh, I'm sorry. There, and then there.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, first off, what camera you used in creating this film, and the other question for me was, what was your biggest challenge during the whole process of making this film?
Sure. The camera was a Sony F35, and the biggest challenge was I wish that we had a bigger budget. You know, more budget means more time. You know, I wouldn't have blown anything up. I just would have had more time to spend with the actor. I could have had more days to work on more pages. You know, we're flying through. A lot of the stuff you saw was like first or second take. Wow. Not a lot of time for rehearsal. Not a lot of time to really get into it. So, you know, and that affects the end product. But other than that, it was a lovely process. Yeah. Under a million. Way under a million. That's what my publicist says. Hey? Under a million. Way. Under a half million. How about that?
And actually, I have along the same lines in terms of funding then, given that you had done a film before this, did you have any funding or support going into it, or did you funded it yourself and now you're finding a distributor?
My first film, I Will Follow, I funded myself with my own cash. I made that film for $50,000. And some of the proceeds for that I put into the next film, and then we raised it. My producing partner, Howard Barish, raised it with private equity. We raised it in about 3 months based on the success of the film before, basically showing you can make a small film at a price and still make it look good. And, you know, if we keep it low enough, we can make our money back and make another one. So, you know, we'll never be quadrillionaires, but we'll definitely be able to make films.
All right. Yeah. Woo-hoo. Okay. Ava, I sat in that theater and I was proud. I was proud. I posted on Facebook, middle of nowhere, tasty, and that I'm about to start riding the bus more. And I sent several
riding
texts.
Riding the bus so you can find a bus driver like
curious. Yeah. I just want to see.
I hear you, my sister.
I'm about to get on the bus just in case. Just in case. It was so intelligent. It was such a tasty, intelligent project. As we were talking, some of the Fuller students, I wondered, everyone, this is a very advanced group, so we're having this like next level conversation with these next level people. When it goes out into the mass market, will we still have this next level group that will have the same experience as what those of us here at the festival have? Or will they see black faces and assume, oh, this is a black movie for black people, there's no rowdy church scene, and so that's gonna cut out some of the different. How do you think the population beyond this very advanced audience will receive your project?
I don't know, I tried to construct the film so that there was something in it for everyone, really. I mean, I think that there are pieces in this film that would appeal to people who see Tyler Perry movies and who just don't really watch cinema, you know? There are pieces in it that people who are cinephiles and only watch art house pieces, you know, I believe the cinematography and some of the pacing and will be something that they recognize. And so, you know, I'm really trying to cultivate a black art house audience, not only black people that see art house films, but art house people who see black films that fit into that space, because they're really, the films are being made, but both sides are not coming together in that space. I mean, my ideal audience is half Tyler Perry crowd, half like, Lars von Trier crowd, you know, that's a powerful crowd, and yeah, just to bring people together around these films and have much less segregation, because I think there's commonalities in it, and there's something in it for everyone. People may get it at a different level, you know. Someone's just going in to see Omari Hardwick in the tight white T-shirt come out with the tats, like, that's okay, that's fine. Maybe as you do that, you see some beauty in that relationship, and something comes. Someone else is watching it for the cinematography and the story points and the narrative structure. You know, it's hopefully a little bit for everyone.
One more in the back of the front, or two more. Okay, two more quick questions.
Hi, loved your film. I was walking out of the theater
nice
and was
smile.
Able to.
Oh, did people tell you that? It's a really nice smile.
Thank you. I was walking out the theater and was able to shake hands with your main actress as tears were streaming down her face. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about your creative process with her. Obviously, so much pressure on her, and how much of this film was. I know because you wrote it, a lot of it was your own life experience, but maybe what had she contributed in the whole creative process?
Yeah, thank you for the question about Imiatsi. And this film is not my life experience. It's not anything to do with my life experience. It was observation and imagination and trying to kind of bring that in. Actually, someone walked up to me and said, how long does your husband have? I was like, I don't have a husband, and I don't know. She was lovely. I found her through the audition process. We became fast friends. She was very intuitive. The scarf thing, her idea, not in the script. You know, so she was very in tune with the character. There's a couple points in the film, because Imiatsi, and I wish that she was here, is a very faithful woman. There's a couple of points in the film where she, you know, at the very beginning when she sits down, she says, I have cheap Chinese food. She sits down. Her mother's asking her questions, barraging her with questions, and her head is down as she's praying over her food. She did that throughout. Like, just there's little things throughout who she thought Ruby was. And so our collaborative process was very much trying to keep the door open for her to bring herself to the character and her thoughts on what it was. When you write a script, sometimes you can be really stringent about it. I had to really challenge myself to just stay open. She's in every frame of the film. It is her first film. She didn't even have like supporting roles in other feature films. Like, first film, you're in every frame of the movie, and I'm gonna make your face gigantic from the top of the screen to the like, I'm on you the whole time. And she did it. And she walked off the plane at Sundance, and she, you know, she lives in North Hollywood in a little apartment. She got off the plane at Sundance, immediately stepped out of the plane. Paparazzi rushed her. They had pictures of her to sign. She's like, how do these people have pictures of me? I'm like, babe, they take them off the internet. They blow them up. They're going to sell them. Just sign it. You know what I mean? Like, she's just like, what's happening? But she was graceful throughout. And every time she sees a film, she just has a lot of emotion. So it's great. Hopefully she stays that way for a long time.
Yeah. Really quick, Elijah.
The music in the movie, I loved it a lot. I have two questions related to that. The first one is, what was your process for how the music worked into the film? Like, was it later or during, before, whatever, how'd that work? And I have to know what the song was that was playing the first time she comes home from a night shift.
Right.
And goes to...
Great, thank you, thank you. I have a black woman composer. Her name is Catherine Bostick. She's actually an alumni of the Sundance Composers Lab, and this is the second film we've worked on together. And then I had a black woman music supervisor who worked with me to choose all the songs. And basically, I told her the artists that I love, and she was like, yeah, well, let's get some of those, and I have some other ones for you. And we put it together like that as a tapestry all afterward. Some of the music that's in it is just music that I was listening to as I was writing and as I was on set. So Michelle Indeghiacello is there, and Fink is there, and just kind of, it's soul music, but it's not like R&B radio. It's like got a bit of an edge. It's like stuff you won't hear on the radio. very kind of underground alternative. The song that you hear at the beginning in that moment, it's like a little like ambient, like weird sounds and this great voice, is a woman named Rare Valverde. And she made that song just for our film, so I don't even think it has a title. But I'm happy to send it to you on MP3 if you'd like. And yeah, she's amazing. she did a song in my first film, I Will Follow, that people loved. And so we invited her back. She's incredible. She's a backup singer for Erykah Badu. And she writes her own beautiful music on the side.
Okay. Well,
I will.
We all want the MP3.
Okay, I will.
We'll share it. Last thing, Ava, I just want to wrap up. We want to thank you again so much for coming. And I want to know, how can we support you? I believe that you'll be releasing this through Affirm. I don't know what you'll do if you have everybody else comes at you and wants you to release it. Would you do a co-release? But tell us what's next and how we can support this film.
I just would love to keep in touch with, we need to have more people. I believe social media really for our films and independent films is the way to stay connected. Please, you know, join us on Twitter and Facebook. We're always on, we're always giving updates, saying where we are, giving information, screening here. This is the way to keep in touch with the film. If you liked it, we need that support to stay connected with us and then to share the word. All you have to do, it's not like the old days where I'm like, can you tell people about it? Then you have to send an email. And no, it's like you press share and it goes out to all your people. Like, it's very easy. And, you know, when we open that way, you'll know, and hopefully we can call on you for some help. It's really about butts and seats with this to allow us to make more films of this kind. If there was anything in it that spoke to you or anything in it that you hope you can see more of, this thing's got to work. We've got to support the films when they come. We can't just say, that was fantastic. You should make more of those. Like, we can only make them if we can show that they work. So I know you all know that. And hopefully we're middle of nowhere on Facebook. We're middle nowhere, no of, on Twitter. And my personal Twitter is AVADVA. And I hope we can stay connected. I really appreciate this forum. It's so hectic out there on Maine. It's like crazy over there. And I've been going since we got off the plane. This is just such a nice environment. So thank you, everyone, very much. Really.
Thank you, Ava. We really appreciate it.
Hi, this is Dick Staub, and I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of The Kindling's Muse. Please go to our website, thekindlings.com, for more information on other shows and to learn how you can become an associate member.